Well, tonight, we're going to have a very special event. And also, to avoid boring our regulars, I'm personally going to sort of presume that you have a basic biblical background on Israel. One of the things that we need to understand is that the Bible is a message system of 66 books penned by 40 different guys over thousands of years that are demonstrably an integrated message. And I don't mean just thematically. Every number, every place name is there by design. So this entire package of 66 books penned by 40 guys over thousands of years is an integrated message. And once you discover that, the second discovery is really staggering, and that's to realize the origin of that message is from outside the dimensionality of time. And one of the ways God demonstrates his authorship, see, if he has the technology to create us in the first place, he has the technology to get a message to us. The problem is, how does he authenticate his message? How does he let us know that the message is really from him and not some kind of contrivance or a fraud of some kind? Well, one way he does that is to rely on an attribute that he alone has. He's not somebody that has lots of time. He's someone outside the physical dimension of time itself. And he knows history before it happens, and he writes history in advance. So if you want, you say you can't prove the Bible wrong, you can. And the way you do it is by demonstrating the dozens of places that the Bible writes history before it happens. But if you want to know what time it is on God's calendar, all you have to do is look at Israel. Quite apart from your attitudes or whatever you about Israel literally and so forth, it is God's time clock. Its origin, its ups, its downs, its entire history was written in advance. And it's one of 10 different strategic trends we monitor on our website. I think most of you in this audience are familiar with that. If you're not, I encourage you to take a look at our website. K-House, no one can pronounce Koinonia House. Koinonia is the Greek word for communication or fellowship. Our ministry is called Koinonia House, but no one can pronounce it, let alone spell it. Everyone calls us K-House. So our website is khouse.org. And on that website, you will find us explain, give backgrounds, and monitor day-to-day, week-to-week, those ten strategic trends. One of them, in fact, the key one, is Israel. And if you want to know where we are in God's plan, Israel's always where you look. And once you understand that, you'll begin to realize that we are on the threshold of the climax of all human history. Now, many of you in this audience are used to having me go on and prattle about the origin and the commitments that the God of the universe has made to this peculiar people called Israel, a peculiar covenant relationship he has with them. What many of you may not realize is every benefit that you and I have in Jesus Christ, we derive, strangely, from the covenant with Abraham. Very bizarre. You see, whether you realize it or not, we worship from a Jewish Bible in a church that was founded by Jewish leadership and so on. And so even as Gentiles, we owe a debt to the Jewish people, collectively and individually in many ways. But if we want to know what's going on in God's program, we need to understand Israel, not just because of our love for Israel and all those considerations, but just as a pragmatic to know what's coming. Now, this gets particularly dramatic because the next 12 to 18 months are obviously going to be more turbulent than any of us probably have a willingness to face. I just got back a little over a month ago from being treated as an invited civilian participant to the National Security Forum at the Air War College at Maxwell Air Force Base. And we were briefed by the CIA, the DIA, and so on and so forth. I'm not at liberty to discuss in detail what we found out, but I can tell you I've never come away. I spent a good part of my life, as most of you know, in the strategic community, not only in the Air Force, but also in the intelligence community, and then as chairman of the board and CEO of four different publicly traded defense contractors. So I have at least a perspective that contributes to my prejudices and opinions. And I can tell you I've never been more stunned and more proud and more comfortable of our military, on the one hand. But I also believe that there isn't anyone that I've met in that establishment that has any real idea of what's likely to happen over the next 6 to 12 months. One of the things, of course, that we're here to do is to try to bring you up to date on what's forthcoming. One of the questions that I get asked as I travel, Chuck, where on earth do you get your information? Because you know that from time to time we've scooped the general news. And I usually quip with my tongue in my cheek. I just make it up. But there is a ground rule in journalism. And by the way, we also are privy to a lot of classified stuff that I can't use. Yet my friends in the E-ring of the Pentagon have learned that unless they give me a public document with some notes in the margin, I can't use what they give me because it's a violation of security. When they send me a published article and highlight a few things so I can connect the dots, I can use that. But one of the ground rules in journalism is that you don't disclose your sources. But I'm going to violate that tonight. Because in July of 2001, we had a speaker here on this platform that happened in the course of things to predict the World Trade Center debacle that happened a few months later. And that, of course, needless to say, put him on the map. A lot of people were followers of him before, but that, of course, propelled him into the worldwide limelight. And I'm speaking, of course, of a dear friend, a friend that I regard as a member of the family. He's a very, very close personal friend. And rather than prattle along stuff that you've heard me say before, or you can easily find out from one of our other tapes that we can accompany this with, if you happen to be listening to the tape, that's fine. But I want to give as much time as we can to my dear friend, Avi Lipkin. Avi? Will you stand, please? I want him to tell his wife that he got a standing ovation. But before we start, I start kidding him. Let's bow our hearts with a word of prayer. Father, we just thank you that in your kingdom there are no accidents, no coincidences. That we're all here right now by your divine appointment. And Father, we simply ask that you in your sovereignty, with all your resources, would just see to it that your purpose is accomplished in each of our lives as we just commit this evening and ourselves into your hands as we come before you in the name of the God of Abraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov and Yeshua, our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. Amen.
Thank you very much.
Now, one of the questions that you all want to ask him, I've been around enough to know that everybody asks him, were you really ever a member of the Mossad? And you need to understand that anybody that was has an oath to lie, you see? So he will deny it. That doesn't mean he was in the Mossad, but it means if he was, he would deny that he was. So I just thought I'd help you with that, you see? You got it, buddy.
Thank you very much. And if my radio and TV booking agent gets me onto Hannity and Combs and they ask me, were you on the Mossad? I'll say, well, of course I deny it. But seriously, I was not in the Mossad, and yet the Saudis gave me a lot of credit in their article. Now, you don't read Arabic. I have the English translation on the table, and it's free. Just come to the table. We'll give you a copy of the English translation. And I kind of wanted to start with this just as a footnote. And the reason I'm starting with this as a footnote is because there is a movement afoot to stifle freedom of speech and freedom of religion. And this movement is an Islamic movement. And it's not maybe so much here in America, because you do not yet have the Holocaust law in the United States. You have it in Canada, you have it in Australia, you have it in Switzerland, and I was just in Switzerland. That's why the Saudis put me on the first page of their newspaper. You know the actor Rodney Dangerfield? He says, I don't get no respect. Well, now the Saudis gave me a lot of respect. So now you have to give me a lot of prayer. But, of course, you know, we all believe, we all know to whom is the victory. And my message tonight is not intended to be a depressing message. It'll be maybe an alarming message, but it is going to be, in the end, good news. What Islam is trying to do is to stifle any criticism of Islam. I call it not criticism, I call it the truth. And it's borne out in the Bible, and it's borne out by current events. And so you have to be very vigilant here in America to make sure that Congress will never, ever adopt the same law that Canada and Australia and certain countries in Europe have adopted, called the hatred laws. The hatred law says you cannot preach against any other religion. This is a very dangerous thing, because what happens is then anyone who preaches the gospel is going to go to jail. And that's what happened just now in Australia, and it happened in Canada. I know the man who was convicted, a missionary, a preacher, convicted of the hatred laws because he was preaching the gospel. What was he saying? He was saying if Muslim children can pray in Canadian schools in Mississauga, which is just outside of Toronto, but it's not fair then that Christian and Jewish kids cannot pray. So that he was convicted of the hatred laws. See, Islam can get away with anything in this country, and of course Judeo-Christianity cannot. In my second book, I have a quote which I received actually from a group called Women Aglow. They sent me an article from July 4th, 1998, from a Hayward, California newspaper, The Daily Review. And the quote that I quote is an interview with Omar Ahmad, who was the head of the Council on American-Islamic Relations. And he says, Islam is not in America merely to be equal to any other religion, but to become the dominant religion. The Quran, which is the book of Islam, must be the supreme scripture in America, and Islam the only accepted religion on earth. This is in America. In other words, the plans are afoot in America. And it could be, unfortunately, that the Ten Commandments were taken out of that Alabama courthouse, and the Christians did not protest. When I say Christians did not protest, you should have had 10, 20, 30 million people protesting in the streets. So the Bible is not allowed to be taught in schools, but the Quran is forced reading. 3-week courses in 7th grade social studies classes that American kids must learn about Islam. They must learn about jihad. They must learn how to recite the Shahada. The Shahada, basically, if you say it, you've become a Muslim. They're making American kids convert to Islam in American schools. It's a very cleverly designed plot. By whom? By your friends, the Saudis. And you cannot build a church in Saudi Arabia. And you cannot pray openly as Christians. And I, as a Jew, am not allowed by law to step on Saudi soil. That's how much they hate the Jews. Anyway, so thank you very much to the Saudis, and I'm very appreciative of the Saudis because this has given me the wherewithal to go public in Israel, to do my books in Hebrew, and start preparations for a Judeo-Christian political party in Israel, which I hope will run in the next official elections in 2007. So this is something we'll talk about at the very end of the message. What I'm going to do now, I'm going to start with the end of the message, and then it'll be flashbacks. What I'm going to do in the first session is to talk about the five deceptions of Islam. A lot of Americans don't have a clue about 9/11. A lot of Americans, even today, are under the deception that Islam is a religion of love, Islam is a religion of peace, we all serve the same God, that Jesus Christ of Islam is the same Jesus Christ of Christianity, and that the Quran is the divine infallible word of Allah to Muhammad. These are the five deceptions of Islam. And I'm going to be spending the first hour basically on this message. In the second hour, we're going to talk about the missile threat to Israel. And this is what I think we have to focus on in the second hour. And then for those of you who are not tired of sitting for 2 hours, I mean, I won't be offended if you leave. I'm not here to talk less, I'm here to talk more. And I was told technically we have 3 hours of tape, and so I am available for questions and answers. And I talk till you drop. The subject is a very weighty subject. It's not a very pleasant subject, and so I try to pepper the message with some funny points and jokes. And I wanted to start out with one of the proofs, I believe, of God's existence. I'm driving across the United States in April, a year and a half ago. I arrived with Alal in New York. I picked up my car there at my father's house. My father's 89, by the way. praise God. He does my accounting. He goes to the bank. He has a 69-year-old girlfriend. And so I get the car, and I start driving cross-country to California. And I leave on Monday, and I'm supposed to arrive in Oakland, California on Friday to speak before the Judeo-Christian Zionist Conference in Oakland with Rosemary Schindler. I don't know if any of you have heard of her. And a very special Christian woman. And I had a few detours. I got held up. I had to do a TV show in Odessa, Midland, Texas with Pram Tam. Primetime Christian TV in Odessa, and then I had to go to Skip Isaac's church in Albuquerque. And to make a long story short, the sun is setting Friday afternoon. The Sabbath is rapidly approaching, and there is no way I'm going to make it to Oakland. And I'm driving 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours on Highway 40, heading towards Barstow. And you know there's nothing there for 2, 3, 4 hours. And the sun is about 2 fingers above the horizon, which means the Sabbath is there almost. And I called a rabbi in Oakland, the Chabad rabbi, who also spoke at the Judeo-Christian conference. And I apologized, and I said to him, you know, Rabbi, I'm not going to make it. I'm going to stop in Barstow for the Sabbath. He said, by all means. He told me where the synagogue was. I went to the synagogue, prayed with the Jews the Friday night service. And then after that, we had dinner. And then they said, well, across the street is the Ramada Inn. And, you know, in Barstow, for those of you who have been there, you have all these motels. And they said they're all really rather sleazy places. And that the Ramada Inn is the only really respectable place in town. So I went across the street to check in. And as I'm entering the hotel, this very beautiful, elegant black lady standing there. Very tall, very pretty. And she curtsies. She says, welcome to Barstow. How are you today? And I was in a mean mood after driving 5 days across the United States. And having to stop in the middle of the Mojave Desert instead of making it to the rabbi's house and have a nice kosher Shabbat meal. And I said to her, I'm very tired. I've just driven across the United States of America, and I think I'll feel a lot better after I've checked in, taken a shower, and gone to sleep. So I go to the reception, and this black lady goes to the reception also. I thought she was a hostess or official receptionist from the hotel. And the receptionist comes out and says, what can I do for you two? And I had to think fast. I said, Lord, give me the words. And then all of a sudden it came to me. This lady was here first. Ladies first. And so this black lady says, my pastor wants a bottle of bottled water. Where is the dispenser? And so she was told where to get the water for her pastor. I said, tell me, what's going on? She said, well, our church is celebrating its 25th anniversary here at this Ramada Inn. And my pastor sent me to get a bottle of water. I said, tell me, what church do you go to? So she said, oh, it doesn't really matter. I just go to some non-denominational charismatic church. So I said to her, well, I'm a Jew from Israel, and I preach in Christian churches. And non-denominational charismatic are my favorite churches. And all of a sudden her eyes go like this. She says, I know you. I know that voice. Yesterday, Thursday, I received your tape, The Legacy of Hate. And I listened to it 3 times. And your wife's name is Rachel, and she's from Egypt, and she taught you everything you know about Islam. And yes, you said you just drove across the United States. I know who you are. Your name is Avi Missler. And you know, that proves to me God's existence, because nobody knew that I was stopping in Barstow, California, in the middle of the desert, unscheduled stop, and God was speaking to me through that black woman to say to me, I know where you are at every given moment, and I'm always with you. And you know, many times, you need a little nudge from God to confirm that he's with you. Okay, what I want to do, indeed, it may seem strange to have like a Bible teaching for the first hour. But the purpose of the Bible teaching in the first hour is to show you that you might not necessarily believe in God, but you have to understand that the people who are coming up against America today are people who are religious people, and their religion is teaching them to do this war against Jews and Christians and against Hindus and Buddhists and even against fellow Muslims. And so the nature of the enemy is a religious nature, but the nature of their God is a religious nature. So you have to understand the religious framework in which this war is taking place. And I always say that I will be willing and glad to meet with atheists, apostates, and New Agers, because the Muslims will kill them too. Muslims, the Islamic religion, is an equal opportunity destroyer. The Islamic bombs and the suicide bombers don't ask you what church, synagogue, or mosque you belong to. Or are you atheist, apostate, or New Ager? And the threat of Islam is a threat which is, if it succeeds, God forbid, will destroy the world. Now what I want to do is, watching the clock, and again, I'm going to keep this very short, because this first hour that we're doing, I do in 3 hours normally. And the second hour, I do in 6 hours. So we're going to be distilling, and I'm going to speak very quickly. And if I speak quickly, then when you go home with the tape, you can just put it on half speed or third speed. And I want you to know I'm a person who's doing penitence. I'm guilty of two very major sins. One is the sin of hatred, and the other is the sin of ignorance. And you have to understand the penitence as an answer to the two sins in order to understand how I understand the Islamic way of thinking and why I'm coming here to warn you. And first I want to say that, you know, when you have something and you don't appreciate it, then when you lose it, that's when you appreciate it. I was born in the United States of America, and I never hated this country. I love this country. I moved to Israel at age 19 for Zionist reasons, but also because I felt that the Christians hated me. And living in the Middle East 35 years, let me tell you, has made me a bigger lover and appreciator of America than I ever was in the first 19 years of my life. When you lose America, that's when you appreciate America. And living in the Middle East 35 years, I can see just how close you are to losing America. And I'm going to be getting back to the anointing that God has placed on America. But first I want to explain a little bit about myself. This will take 5-10 minutes, and then we will get into the five deceptions, and then probably in the second hour we'll talk about the role, as I see it, of the United States of America in saving the world from itself. Like I said before, I used to hate Christians. By the way, I never hated the Muslims, and I don't hate the Muslims now. And this business of the Saudis, that they're suing this Christian gentleman, Werner Scherer, who brought me to Switzerland to speak, because we broke together the racism and hatred laws, this is outright ridiculous. Because I love the Muslims. They're human beings created in the image of God. What I hate is a Nazi-like system which calls for the destruction of my people, the Jews. But Islam calls not only for my destruction, it calls for the destruction of the Christians, the Hindus, the Buddhists, and even fellow Muslims. Islam is a satanic, warlike, destructive system. My family came from Russia, from Poland, over 100 years ago. They fled from the persecution of the Tsars to go to Argentina. Argentina is a primarily Roman Catholic country. My parents grew up in totally Catholic, Christian neighbors. There were no Jews in the area. They knew that they were Jews, but that's all they knew. My parents never learned Hebrew. They never went to synagogue. And their lives were totally Argentine, just like their fellow Catholic neighbors. When they came to America, my parents decided that because I was so ignorant they were ignorant of Judaism, that they wanted me to go to Hebrew school. So I went to Hebrew school. I was born in 49, so in 1955 I started going to Hebrew school at age 6. 1955 was only 10 years after the end of World War II. Therefore, it is understandable that the emphasis in Hebrew school would be the Holocaust. And you all know that the Jewish people today focus very much on the Holocaust museums and on the Holocaust traditions, and it was a terrible thing. We lost a third of our people. And I don't know if I was right or I was wrong, but my conclusions were that I had to hate the German people. And then we were taught about the persecutions in Russia, the Tsarist persecutions and then the communist persecutions. So I hated the Russians. It was also at the height of the Cold War. We were taught about the Catholic Inquisition. So I hated Spain, Portugal, France, and Italy. And you know what? Even the white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, you know, the WASPs of America, never killed the Jews. Jews were only blessed in America. But what we used to say in Hebrew school, what we were taught and what we used to say was, rest assured that they will come, that the white Anglo-Saxon Protestants of America will also kill us. Because Jews always live 100, 200, 300, 400 years maximum, then they get slaughtered. And so I said to myself, you know what, better just to pick up and leave. And I moved to Israel at age 19. I went, again, there was a Zionist pull, prophetic, a biblical pull to go home, because it says the Jews will go home. And then there was this misconceived notion of anti-Semitism pushing me out of the United States. And so I moved to Israel at age 19. I meet my wife January 14th, 1970. And the very first thing my wife says to me when we start, you know, talking seriously, the first thing she says, which is what she always starts our conversations with, she says, "Are you crazy?" My wife always starts the conversation, "Are you crazy?" And she always ends the conversation, "You don't know anything." That's the way it's been for 35 years. And my wife says to me, "Why did you leave America?" And I said to her, "Because the Goyim hate us." How many people here know what the word Goyim is? Okay, now Goyim is a Hebrew word which is plural of the word Goy. Goy means a nation. The children of Israel at Mount Sinai differentiated themselves from the rest of the world 3,500 years ago by accepting the Torah. Therefore, we became Goy Kadosh. We became a holy nation. The Goyim, the nations, are the heathens, the pagans, those who were not part of Israel. So I said to my wife, you know, the Jews in America say that the Christians are the Goyim. Now, by the way, how many people here, you know, I go to church. I go to church 5 days a week. Friday, Saturday, I go to synagogue. I'm going to talk about that in a minute. And I go into churches, and pastors get up and say, "We Gentiles must bless the Jews." How many people here feel that you're Gentiles? I see some hands there, some hands there. Okay, now, put your down your hands. Never raise your hands again when I ask that question. My wife says to me, "You don't know anything." See, in Egypt and in the Islamic lands, there are three groups. You have the Jews, the Christians, and the Muslims. The Jews and the Christians are called in Arabic, Ahl el-Kitab. Ahl el-Kitab. Kitab is the Bible, and Ahl is the people, not the peoples. The Jews and the Christians are the people, singular, of the book. We have the same God, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. We have the same Bible. And we all agree that the Messiah is a Jew who speaks Hebrew. So for the Christians, that's Jesus Christ of Nazareth. The Jews don't know yet who the Messiah is, but for the Christians, he's a Jew who speaks Hebrew. For the Christians, he's a Jew who speaks Hebrew. The Muslims, they are the Gentiles. The Muslims, they are the Goyim, because they have another God, Allah, who is not the same God as the Jews and the Christians. They have another book called the Quran, and the Quran is a replacement theology book. The Quran replaces the Bible of the Jews and the Christians. And thirdly, the Messiah is a Muslim. In other words, Jesus comes back a second time as a Muslim to kill all the Jews and the Christians, to kill those of the Ahl el-Kitab, the people of the book. So the Muslims, they are the Gentiles. They are the Goyim. Christians cannot be Gentiles. So I hope I've taught you something that you might not have thought of before. And I'll tell you, I always listen to my wife, but it takes me sometimes 20 or 30 years before it sinks in. And this teaching about the Christians and the Jews being one people, I heard it, but I didn't understand it. That was in 1970. And it wasn't until 1986, 1987, I was 37, 38 years old, still hated the Christians. And you have to remember, even my mother and father said to me, you know, they never taught me to hate Christians, but they said, you know, historically, when the Catholic Church was persecuting the Jews, it was the Islamic countries that took in the Jews. And I'll tell you something which is kind of funny. In 1966, this is before the 67 war, I was a freshman at New York University in Manhattan, New York City. And I used to go to the meetings of the Arab Student Organization. And they received me nicely, and I liked them very much, and they liked me. And one day, I got angry with them. This is in 1966. You know, we were still in the borders of 1948. And I said to them, "What's the matter with you Muslims?" I said to them. "Why did you let Ferdinand and Isabella defeat us in 1492? We had the golden age. The Jews, the Christians, and the Muslims together had the golden age in Spain. It was terminated by the Catholic monarchs, Ferdinand and Isabella, in 1492. Why did you let these barbarians defeat you?" And they looked at me, and they really didn't have an answer for me. So I just want you to know, I did not hate the Muslims then. And I don't hate the Muslims today. And I'll explain to you also why I don't hate the Muslims. I'll get to that as we go along. 1986, an article appears in the Jerusalem Post an ad looking for English-speaking Israelis to correspond with American Zionist Christians. Now, I heard American Zionist Christians, and that sounded to me like an oxymoron. How can a Christian be a Zionist? And I said, I have to check it out. And I start writing to this Nancy in Texas, and she writes me these nauseatingly sweet letters that only Christians can write to Jews. And let me tell you, the scales began to fly hard and fast from my eyes. See, I used to say all Christians were bad people. That's why I left America, to be in Israel, to be away from the Christians. And she writes me a letter, you Jews, you're all wonderful people. You Jews, you're all good people. And I almost wanted to throw up. Because living in Israel, I know that there are good Jews and there are bad Jews. And I said to her, there are good Jews and there are bad Jews, just like there are good Christians and there are bad Christians. That was scale number one that came off my eyes. God has a sense of humor. What can I say? Then she writes me another letter, please forgive me for the Holocaust. I said to her, are you Yellow Rose of Texas? I said to her. You were born in 51 after the Holocaust. You were born in the hill country of Texas. You were never in Europe. You were never outside of Texas. You were never outside of the hill country. There's nothing to forgive. You're innocent. But one of the lessons I learned from that was that Christians, by their true nature as Christians, are innocent, but they bear the guilt of the world on their shoulders. Because that's what Jesus did. So that was scale number two. Yellow Rose of Texas says to me, you all come to Texas, and I'll open up the churches and synagogues and radio and TV, and she kept her word. And so in November of 1990, I go to her church in New Braunfels, Texas. I was 41 years old. I had never in my life attended a Christian church of any kind. And here I am in this church, white people, black people, Hispanics, Native Americans, all holding hands, all loving God, preacher preaching for Israel, loving Israel, and all of a sudden, the next scale comes off my eyes. That not only was Nancy crazy, but the whole church was crazy. And people were speaking in tongues, and people were falling to the ground. I mean, this is a shock for a Jew when he goes for the first time to a Christian church. But they were loving Israel, and they were crying tears for Israel. And so I realized that that whole church of 400 people, that they loved Israel. And this was a shock. And I get into a lot of trouble with my fellow Jews, because I say, fellow Jews, you have to go to church on Sunday. They say, oh, a Jew for Jesus. And I say, no, I'm not a Jew for Jesus, but when you go to church, you can feel the love that the Christians have for us. And indeed, many times when I'm in my home synagogue in New York where I grew up, they say, where are you going now? I say, I'm going to Texas or Idaho or California or wherever. They say, why are you going there? They hate us. I say, you have to go to church. If you go to Christian church, you'll see how the Christians love the Jews. And secondly, you'll learn the Bible from another perspective, which is equally valid. So they say, we don't go to synagogue on Saturday. Why should we go to the church on Sunday? So I'm in this church, and there were white people, black people, Native Americans, and Tex-Mex Hispanics, but the whites were blonde, blue-eyed people. They looked like Germans. And, you know, in San Antonio area, you have a lot of bases. All these people were crew cuts. They looked like Nazi soldiers from the 1930s. But they were crying tears for Israel. See, I hated the Germans. And I could see their love. I said, you know what? These are American Germans. They came 150 years ago. It's okay. They're kosher. This is just a few years ago. 1996, the Christian Embassy invites me to screen The Jihad in America. How many people have seen the PBS video Jihad in America by Stephen Emerson? I have maybe 6-7 copies on the table. This was made in 1994 after the first attack on the World Trade Center in 1993. And the bottom lines of this movie were, firstly, that Islam wants to establish an international empire and destroy the United States. And secondly, if at first you don't succeed, try again. In other words, if they didn't succeed in destroying the World Trade Center in 93, that they would try again. And they did. And they did succeed. The movie had quotes like, Faiz Azam, one of the Islamic leaders in Atlanta in 1991, says, the religion of Allah requires scalps. There must be widows. There must be orphans. There must be blood. Arms and limbs must be cut, and blood and limbs must be spread everywhere so that the religion of Allah will stand on its feet. Another quote, for example, was Sheikh Abdulaziz Udeh, December 30th, 1990, just before Desert Storm. He says, and now Allah is bringing back the Jews in large groups from all over the world to Palestine, to their mass graveyard, where the promise will be kept and destiny will be realized upon the Jews. So So this was the second quote. And then they were talking about blowing up airplanes and blowing up the World Trade Center. And this movie was made with the help of the FBI, the CIA, and the State Department. You all heard of Paul Bremer in Iraq? He stars in this movie. He's not anti-Muslim. And the movie was buried for being anti-Muslim. It wasn't anti-Muslim. It was anti-terrorism. And Stephen Emerson got blacklisted everywhere. He got a death sentence. And I've been selling thousands of these tapes in the last 10 years. So I screened this in front of the Christian embassy in Jerusalem. And two gentlemen come up to me looking very European, you know, with a beret and a scarf and a sweater underneath a jacket. I mean, it's very European. And they say to me, "Would you like to come and speak in our Staatshunige der Logische Hochschule?" And I said to myself, there's no way I'm going to Germany. No way. And I said, "Where's your seminary?" You know, they had a seminary for pastors. And I said, they said, "In Basel, in Switzerland." I said, "Well, they were neutral in World War II. That's kosher. I'm going." I'm speaking in the same hall where Theodor Herzl spoke 100 years before in 1897, where he predicted that within 50 years there would be a Jewish state. I'm speaking before 5,000 people. And I could see the tears in their eyes. And also the Israel Today magazine, which is now in English, I saw it in German. I met Ludwig Schneider, the publisher. This is a magazine you all need to get, by the way. And I could see the tears in their eyes. I said, "Boy, these Swiss Germans, they're not like the German Germans. They're not like the Austrian Germans. And, you know, they're kosher also." And so during the reception, they're all hugging me and kissing me and loving me like Christians do. And I said, "What part of Switzerland are you from?" He said, "Nein, Deutschland." "No, Germany." Or, "Nein, Österreich." "They're from..." "No, they were from Austria." I said, "I'm in the lion's den. These are all Nazis." Because Jews think that all Germans and all Austrians are Nazis. But these people loved Israel. And then Ludwig Schneider of the Israel Today magazine says to me, "You've got to get your books out in German." And I said, I'm going to work with the Germans." "No, you have to. This publisher is a German Christian Zionist." That's a triple oxymoron. And his name is Hensler. And he was shut down by the Nazis because in the 1930s he was printing church hymnals. And they said to him, "It's okay to print church hymnals. All you have to do is just delete Israel and Zion." And so he laughed and he fell off his chair. He thought it was a joke. The Nazis shut him down. In World War II, they sent his 16-year-old son to the Russian front. Remember Hogan's Heroes? Russian front? That was a death sentence for any German to be sent to the Russian front. And so one day, the 16-year-old German kid, Hensler Jr., they say, take your gun. We're going into the forest shooting." So he thought, shoot bear or deer to supplement their rations. And he could hear the shooting. They went in, and all of a sudden he saw naked women, naked children, and naked men being shot into trenches. And he was supposed to be in the next round of the firing squad. And he said, "Jesus Christ, if you are really in heaven, don't let me kill the Jews." And all of a sudden he heard the firing squad commander say, "Hensler, raus." Hensler, out of the firing line. And Hensler Jr. never killed one Jew in World War II. I said, "These people are going to do my books in German." And praise God, my books are coming out in German now. And the German magazine, Nachrichten aus Israel, is coming out in English because of me. And God has such a sense of humor, because now a Japanese Christian paid for 20,000 editions every month, and the magazine is now coming out in Japanese. So God's word... So God's word is reaching the German people, the Japanese people, the American, the English-speaking people. The point I'm saying is, today I am madly in love with German people. And I don't hate, I only love the Germans. I will fight Nazism to my last breath. I don't hate the Russians, but I will fight communism to my last breath. And I don't hate the Muslims, and I never did. I love the Muslims, but I will fight Islam to my last breath. And I'll say something else. You know, I grew up in the 50s and 60s, and for those of you who are old like me, I grew up with Victory at Sea. I don't know how many of you remember Victory at Sea. This is the musical score written by Richard Rodgers to the TV documentary series. And those of you who saw the movie Patton, you know, I lived World War II, even though I was born in 1949. I know every battle and every general and everything that happened then. And I used to say to myself, and in Hebrew school we used to say this, the United States made a big mistake by dropping the nuclear weapons on Japan. They should have been dropped on the Germans for what they did to us in World War II. And because of you Christians, I got the cooties so bad that today I say I mourn for the 20 million Germans who died in World War II. And many of these Germans were innocent, many were guilty, but even the guilty were deceived by Satan and then destroyed by Satan. Satan wants to destroy every human being on earth because every human being is created in the image of God. This is my message tonight. If you don't get anything else from my message tonight, this is my message. We have a God, and I know that Chuck is now teaching Genesis. Genesis means the creation. God is a creation God. He created all of us. Satan wants to kill all of us. Everything that God likes and loves, Satan wants to destroy. That's how you explain 9/11. So my first sin was the sin of hatred. And I was healed by that, by going to church, by reading the New Testament, and by learning from the Christians. You know, a lot of Christians say, is this guy saved? Is he a Jew or is he a Christian? And if you ask me, I'll tell you, I don't know. And, you know, there's a teaching in the New Testament, ask and will be granted, seek and you shall find, knock and the door will open. So I have asked, and I've been in churches, and then after a few weeks I come back to the church, so if you asked, of course you're a born-again Christian. I said, well, I don't have an answer that will satisfy you, but the same answer will not satisfy the rabbis either. And that is, I brought it before God in my heart. And God says to me, son, don't you snap your fingers at me. When I want you to know, you'll know. Until then, the scales stay on, keep marching and shut up. And that's what I'm doing. But I just want you to know that I'm sincere in seeking to know the truth about Messiah. And at this moment, God is saying, I need you as a Jew of the Jews, because only a Jew of the Jews can do what has to be done in Jerusalem. And that's we'll talk about that at the end of the message. The second sin is the sin of ignorance. This local yokel country bumpkin, Yellow Rose of Texas, Nancy, she knew my Bible. And I was an officer in the Israeli army, and just a lieutenant, and I was a senior editor and translator in the prime minister's office. I did not know the Bible. And, you know, tonight I was having dinner with Chuck, and he was quoting to me from 2 Chronicles and 1 Chronicles. Do you know that I've never read 1 Chronicles and 2 Chronicles? I need a Christian to teach me my book, you know. I decided to go to seminary, the Jewish Theological Seminary, from 1991 to 1994, to become a conservative rabbi. God had other plans for me. Instead of being a pulpit rabbi with 100 families, I became an unordained teacher to about 20, 30 million Christians. So, but I learned something in seminary at the very beginning which changed my life forever. And that is, we were taught in seminary, in Jerusalem, 5 verses from the New Testament. One was about Matthew 23, verse 5, which is the prayer shawl and the phylacteries, that Jesus confirms that these existed 2,000 years ago. But the 4 verses which changed my life forever were Mark 12, 28 to 31. Mark 12, 28 to 31, Jesus, the rabbi, is discussing the law with his fellow rabbis, and the debate is about what is the most important commandment of all. And Jesus says, Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one, and thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy strength, and with all thy might. And that's Deuteronomy 6, 4, 5. The second verse that Jesus teaches is from Leviticus 19:18. Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. And I was shocked, because I always thought the New Testament was written by a Catholic priest in Sicily. You see, Jews don't know that the New Testament is a Jewish book. Jews are not allowed to read the New Testament. If you read the New Testament, you get the cooties. And if you're a Jew, of course. And I get into a lot of trouble with my fellow Jews because I say to my fellow Jews, you Jews need to read the New Testament. They say, Jew for Jesus. And I say, no, I'm not a Jew for Jesus. But when you read the New Testament, you confirm the Old Testament. They say, well, we don't read the Old Testament. Why should we read the New Testament? By the way, there's only one thing worse than Jews for Jesus, and that's Jews for nothing. Excuse me. So, then Jesus does something very remarkable. He says, there are no commandments greater than these two. Love the Lord thy God, love thy fellow as thyself. Out of the 613 commandments, these are the two most important commandments. What is the verb? L-O-V-E. So I've taken the liberty of saying that the whole Bible can be distilled into a four-letter word. L-O-V-E. Our God is a God of love, our book is a book of love, and Messiah has to be a Messiah of love. And I was very shocked by all of this, because Jews don't know that this is at the heart of the New Testament, that these are the two most important teachings according to Jesus of Nazareth. And here I am going to Christian churches, and all I see in the churches is love, love, love. It's overwhelming, for Jews who have never seen this. And praise God, I've been in over 400 churches of many, many denominations. Why do we have to love God? I mean, this may sound so trivial. Like, you've heard these teachings dozens of times, if not hundreds of times. And I'm going to come from a very, very special perspective. It's a perspective I couldn't do 3 years ago. I've been a grandfather for 3 years. When you are a father or mother, or when you are a grandfather or grandmother, you have a different perspective on life. And I think I'm specially qualified now to speak because of my status now as a grandfather. Why should we love God? Because God is our father and our mother. You know, normal parents, when they have children, normal parents want only one thing, and that is for their children to love them. What makes parents happy? When, you know, you look at your child smiling at you, beaming at you. What makes parents upset? When the kids don't care about you. Why should we love our fellow as ourself? Because our fellow as ourself is created in the image of whom? God. What makes parents happy? When brothers and sisters, or brothers and brothers and sisters grow up together and love each other and caress each other and help each other, the happiness that it gives the parents to see their children together. What makes parents upset? When kids are not together. And when they're fighting each other and cursing each other and abusing each other and stabbing each other and shooting each other. And you know that there are families where siblings kill each other. And let me tell you, coming from Israel, I can tell you that the worst possible punishment for a parent is to bury a child. And I've been in the military cemeteries enough time burying children who are friends of my sons in the Israeli army. But it doesn't have to be in the army. Any child who dies in the lifetime of the parent, this is maybe the most terrible punishment for a parent. And I translate this into how God must feel when any human being dies or is persecuted or suffers. God cries for all of us when we die or when we suffer. This is why Jesus says, love the Lord thy God, love thy fellow as thyself. Also, you cannot love God if you hate any human being. What does Jesus teach? I get into trouble for preaching this in the synagogues. Love your enemy. The Muslims are my enemy, but I love them. I don't hate them. I wish they could be saved. So, it's all about love. And one of the things I've learned is that when you hate, it's like you prepare a vial of poison for the person you hate, but in the end you drink the poison. And people who hate do not live very long. You want to live a long life? You have to be a lover. You have to love. You have to love God, and you have to love your fellow human being. Why am I teaching these two commandments this way? And the reason is very simple. The first deception of Islam is that it is a religion of love. Now, are Muslims loving people? Sure they are. They're wonderful people. Why? They're created in the image of God. God is a loving God. If we're in God's image, we have the potential to be loving people. Let me ask you a question, and I couldn't answer this until I was giving this message. Are German people loving people? Of course they are. But are Nazis? Russian people, are they loving people? But are communists? Muslims are loving people, but Islam is not a loving system. And you know how I know? What does Jesus say? Jesus says the two most important commandments are love the Lord thy God, love thy fellows thyself. In the whole Bible. Jesus is confirming in Mark 12 what we see in Deuteronomy and in Leviticus. He's reconfirming and reinforcing what every Jew knows. These two commandments, the two most important commandments, they are not in the Quran. I will pay anyone here $1 million if you can show me where these two commandments are in the Quran. And the Saudis were picking on me because this is my message. And they say to me, they say in the article, Avi Lipkin says there's no love in the Quran. I didn't say that. The word love appears 24 times in the Quran. Allah loves this, Allah loves that. But the context, the commandment, love the Lord thy God, love thy fellows thyself, not in the Quran. Now, if I'm a Jew, or if I'm a Christian, then this has to start the red lights blinking. Something is wrong with the Quran. Something is wrong with the Islamic religion. So that's the first deception. Islam, as a religion, as a system, is not a system of love. Muslims are loving people. Let's look at King David. This will lead me into the next deception, but it's the link from the first deception to the second. We all love King David. King David is the forefather of the Messiah. Jews love King David. Christians love King David. But King David was disqualified by God from building the temple. Why? He was a man of the sword. He had blood on his hands. What's the problem with the sword? The sword is an instrument of death of human beings created in the image of God. And so God has placed a curse on the sword and anyone who holds the sword. And yet the sword is the symbol of Islam. You ever seen the Saudi flag? A green flag with gold letters. There is no God but Allah, and his prophet is Muhammad, and underneath it is the scimitar sword. Solomon was the one who built the temple because Solomon made love, not war. It says in the Bible, when you build an altar unto me, do not use any iron implements, because iron implements are implements of death. Is it fair to assume that God does not like the sword? Why? Because the sword kills those created in the image of God. So we're talking about the two commandments that Jesus says are the two most important commandments. Love the Lord thy God, love thy fellow as thyself. So let's look now at the religion of peace. Islam claims to be the religion of peace. Your president in Washington, D.C. says Islam is a religion of peace. And I know he does this for tactical reasons, but the word Islam comes from the word salam. It's a three-letter root, just like in Hebrew, shalom, which means peace. But the word does not mean peace. It comes from peace, but it doesn't mean peace. It means pacification. You know, pacification comes from peace. How many people here remember the good old days of the Vietnam War? Remember the word, this Viet Cong village was pacified? Usually it meant immolated in napalm. Pacified meant that Viet Cong village did not exist anymore. It was burned out and all the Vietnamese were killed. That's usually what pacification meant. That's what Islam means. Islam means the destruction of the infidel, the suppression or the defeat of the infidel. By its very definition, Islam says there are two houses. There is the house of peace and there is the house of war. Well, isn't that wonderful? Don't we all want to be the house of peace? The only problem, there's a catch. To be a member of the house of peace, you have to be a Muslim. Anybody who's not of a Muslim is the house of war. Now, the Islamic definition of peace is when the house of peace conquers the house of war, when the good guys beat the bad guys. Now, there's only one problem with that. 5/6 of the human race is not Muslim. You've got 2 billion Christians and Jews, mostly Christians, 1 billion Hindus, 2 billion Buddhists, 5/6 of the human race, and then 1.2 or 1.3 billion are Muslims. I want to tell you a joke. I promised you some jokes. What's the difference between neurotic people and psychotic people? Neurotic people dream about castles in the air. Psychotic people live in castles in the air. And psychiatrists collect the rent. Now, Adolf Hitler was psychotic for many reasons. I will focus on two. He thought he could conquer the earth, and he thought he could kill the Jews. These are the two most extreme psychoses of Adolf Hitler. Now, firstly, nobody can conquer the earth. Alexander the Great tried it. The Romans tried it. Napoleon tried it. Hitler tried it. Stalin tried it. Only the Lord has dominion over the earth. No human being can do this. So this is the first psychosis. Anybody who believes that they can conquer the earth, they're psychotic. Second psychosis of Hitler, he thought he could kill all the Jews. Well, in God's kingdom terminology, Jeremiah 31, it says there will be no more Jews on the face of the earth when the moon, the sun, and the stars stop shining. So what does that mean? You better pray for the Jews. Because when the Jews go, there'll be no more moon, sun, or stars, which means no more earth. In this kingdom terminology, if the Jews were sinful and stubborn and stiff-necked, as it says in the Bible, and God said, I will scatter you to all corners of the earth, well, if you can't conquer the earth, you can't kill all the Jews because you can't reach them. So that's the second psychosis. There's no way that all the Jews will be killed. So Adolf Hitler was psychotic. He thought he could conquer the earth, and he thought he could kill the Jews. Well, what does Islam preach? That they can conquer the earth. That's just as bad as the Nazis. They can kill all the Jews, which is just as bad as the Nazis. But the Muslims take it a few steps more. They're going to kill all the Christians, 2 billion. All the Hindus, 1 billion. And all the Buddhists, 2 billion. That's 5/6 of the human race. And then when everybody else is dead, what do the Muslims do? They kill each other. Because you've got some Muslims that are more kosher than other Muslims. Okay? Now, it is a psychological condition to be a Muslim. So after they kill the Jews, the Christians, the Hindus, the Buddhists, you have the utopia. Islamic utopia. Now, what is utopia in English? Utopia means pretty darn good place, right? Perfect place. In Greek, I know Chuck loves Greek, so how do you say utopia in Greek? It's eutopia. Eu in Greek means no. Topia means place, like topography. Eutopia, no place. There is no such place as a utopia. That's what the Greek means. That there isn't such a place. So let's look at the Islamic utopia, because there isn't such a place. Afghanistan. Afghanistan was a country of Hindus, Buddhists, Jews, and Christians. The first to go were the pagans, the Hindus and the Buddhists. Then the Jews and the Christians were next to go. And then there were only Muslims left. And what did the Muslims do in Afghanistan? They killed each other. Do you know that in the last 10 years, over 1 million Afghanis have been killed by each other? You have the Pashtuns, they are the majority, they're related to the Pakistanis. You have the Tajiks and the Uzbeks related to their brethren in the fellow former Soviet Union. And then they have the Hazaras. The Hazaras are Shiites related to the Iranian Muslims. All Muslims and all slaughtering each other. This is the Islamic utopia. And in the end, who has to pick up the pieces and rebuild the country? The Americans. Let's look at another utopia. Algeria. My wife Rachel comes home from work one day crying. Al Jazeera brought in this Algerian terrorist apprehended by the Algerian government. You know, you don't have four different ethnic groups in Algeria. You have only one ethnic group. They are all Sunni Muslims and they're all Algerians. And this terrorist was a fundamentalist fighting the non-fundamentalist Muslim government. And he's describing how they deal with an infidel village, a village which has been, considered an enemy of Islam. In other words, Muslims who collaborate with the government in Algiers. We're talking only about Muslims. There are no Jews and there are no Christians in Algeria. And my wife comes home and she needs to take a Valium, a sedative, because she's so hysterical from what she just saw. This guy, this terrorist, in very cold manner, gets up and he talks about what they do to a village that's considered traitors, fellow Muslims. They wait for the men to go to work at 6 in the morning. Then they go into the village. They circle the village. They don't let anyone in. They don't let anyone out. They go to the women and say, prepare for us a festive meal. And then, after they've had their festive meal, they take a hallucinatory drug to go on a high. You know the word in English, assassin? Assassin comes from Arabic. The Arabic word is hashashin, those who smoke hashish, those who get high on drugs and become murderers. Assassin means a murderer. So they take this hallucinatory drug, they slit the throat, first they rape the women, then they slit their throats, then they take the children and the old people, they slit their throats. It's not over. Then they use high tech. They take electrical chainsaws and they chop off the arms and legs. They dismember the bodies, mutilate the bodies, so that when the men come home that night from work, the men know what happens to anyone who makes war on Allah, war on Muhammad the Prophet, and spreads disorder on the earth. And with your permission, the Saudis were attacking me in their article in Al-Watan for misquoting the Bible. So I want to be sure that I said it right. Chapter 5, verse 33 of the Quran. Those, by the way, I recommend to all of you, if you have a few bucks, get the Quran with parallel Arabic text, Penguin Classics. It has the Arabic and it has the English. And I'll be referring to the differences between the Arabic and the English. Chapter 5. Verse 33 of the Quran. Those that make war against God, Allah, and His Apostle, Muhammad, and spread disorder in the land, shall be put to death, or crucified, or have their hands and feet cut off on alternate sides, or be banished from the country. They shall be held up to shame in this world, and sternly punished in the hereafter. This is what Muslims do to Muslims. Now I want to ask you a question. Do you feel, from what I said, that I hate the Muslims? I'm crying for the Muslims in my heart because I see what they do to each other with this crazy system. I cry for the Germans, for the 20 million who died, when I see what Hitler did to his own people. And the worst case of Islam is Saddam Hussein. Saddam Hussein did not kill Jews or Christians. He killed his own fellow Muslims. I mourn for the Muslims. We're going to talk maybe a little bit in the second hour about the Palestinians. I mourn for the Palestinians. I don't hate them. I love them, and I hurt for them. That's the second deception of Islam, that it is a religion of peace. It is not a religion of peace. It is a religion of eternal war. First they kill the infidel, then they kill each other. And this is because of a prophecy Chuck is teaching this week, Genesis. And I think one of the most terribly truthful prophecies in the Bible is in Genesis 16, where Hagar is pregnant with Ishmael. And the angel of the Lord appears unto Hagar and says, you're going to have a son. His name is going to be Ishmael, because God heard your cries. And he will be the father of many nations. And he will be, listen to this, it says in Hebrew, Pere Adam. Adam means a man, Pere means a mule. He will be a wild donkey. Ever seen a wild donkey kicking in all directions? You can't get near it. His hand will be against all his brethren's hands, and all his brethren's hands will be against his hand, and he will dwell in the face of his brethren. Do you know that the rabbis never teach this in synagogue? I have to learn this in church. Ishmael will be a wild donkey. His hand will be against all his brethren's hands, and all his brethren's hands will be against his hand, and he will dwell in the face of his brethren. This is prophetic. This is a perfect description of Islam today. And a few chapters later, it says, and Ishmael died. Ishmael died in the face of his brethren. He who lives by the sword dies by the sword. So the third deception of Islam, who is Allah and who is God? You know, because you've got people who say we serve the same God. Allah and God are one and the same. And that's the biggest deception of all. And that their God is the God of Ishmael and our God is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So let's first look at our God. Who is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and why? And you want to know something? The book of Genesis, like I said before, Chuck is teaching the book of Genesis. This is a very important book because everything that's happening today was predicted in Genesis. You know how women are so mistreated in Islam? There's such an enmity against women in Islam. And I learned this from Jane Hansen in Women Aglow, chapter 3, verse 15. God says, I will place a permanent curse on the seed of the serpent and the seed of woman. Who's the seed of woman? That's all of us. Who mistreats women? Islam. Where is their enmity with the women? In Islam. And I'm going to show you that Allah is Satan is the serpent. You look at the bottom line, look at the behavior. It's the serpent is Satan. Our God is the God of creation. What's the book of Genesis? Book of creation. In the first reading that the Jews read, which is Bereshit, it starts with the creation and it ends with, it was a generation that did evil and thought evil all day. This is just before Noah, where God decides to destroy the earth. You have the seed of creation and you have the seed of destruction. And I saw something 2 weeks ago on Saturday I never saw before in my life. I've read it many times and I never saw it. Noah was a shepherd. Noah was the father of all shepherds because he had to shepherd two of every animal onto the ark. And Noah had to feed all these animals. Some were nocturnal, some were day animals. You know, so he didn't sleep very much. He had to feed the animals, he had to clean up after them. The rabbis say for a year they were on the ark. And then after the flood, he planted a vineyard, got royally drunk, and he was a farmer. So he was the father of the shepherds and the father of the farmers. But that is the seed of creation. Who are Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? They were farmers, and they were shepherds. Joseph was a shepherd. His brothers were shepherds. Moses was a shepherd. By the way, you know, when the Hebrews went into slavery, before they were slaves in Egypt, when they emigrated from Palestine during the drought, the Egyptians detested the Israelites because they were shepherds. If you remember that verse. How do you describe Jesus? The good shepherd. Moses was a shepherd unto Jethro. So being a shepherd is a very special thing because you're part of God's creation plan. What do we know about Ishmael? He's a man of the sword. That's part of God's destruction plan. What do we know about Esau? He was a man of the sword because Isaac blessed him with a curse. He said, you will live by the sword. He who lives by the sword dies by the sword. What does Jesus say when Peter cuts off the ear of the legionnaire? Put your sword away. He who lives by the sword dies by the sword. Does Jesus like the sword? I don't like the sword. None of us like the sword. We may have to use it at some stage to defend ourselves, but we should not glorify the sword, and that's what Islam does. In fact, Islam describes itself as Deen Asif. Deen Asif is the law of the sword. Okay, now, by the way, something which is very important. Remember I was saying how Jesus confirms Deuteronomy and Leviticus, love the Lord thy God, love thy fellow thyself. That's confirmed in Mark. You know, when I preach to Christians, it's like clapping with two hands, because I've got the Old Testament and the New Testament. When I preach to the Jews on Shabbat, I have to clap with one hand, because I can't use the New Testament, okay? But here we have, seven times in the New Testament, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And the very, very first mention of this is in the first gospel, the first chapter, the first page, the first words of the New Testament. These are the generations of Jesus Christ, and you have 14 generations and 14 generations and 14 generations. What do you have right in the middle of all of that? Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. It doesn't say Ishmael. So if the Muslims say that it was Ishmael, then we have a problem. Is God a liar? Is God crazy? Is God schizophrenic? Or maybe is the Islamic book wrong? Now, God says five times in Genesis. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. First, he says it, if you remember, when Abraham is 99. And God says, you're going to have another son. And his wife is 90. And Abraham almost falls off his chair laughing. And Sarah is in the tent listening. She's laughing. So what's this kid's name? Laughter. Isaac means laughter. And God said, you know, Abraham was a humble man, and he loved his son Ishmael. We never see that Abraham hated Ishmael. He loved Ishmael. And God says, it is not through Ishmael. Ishmael will be blessed. He'll be father of 12 nations. But it is through Isaac your seed will be called. And then the second time we see when Isaac is being weaned from Sarah, and Abraham gives a party, and it says in the King James, I'm going to teach you some Hebrew now, it says in the King James, Sarah saw Ishmael behaving in a haughty manner. How many people know that verse? He was behaving in a haughty manner with Isaac. But you see, the King James is a very Puritan book. Hebrew is a very sexy language. And so this was mistranslated. The word is Sarah saw Ishmael behaving in a litzachek manner. Litzachek, you remember when Isaac and Rebekah were with the king of the Philistines? And he said, this is my sister, not my wife, because he was afraid they'd kill him and take the wife. And then the king of the Philistines saw him sporting with his wife. And then he understood that it was his wife and not his sister. This must have been a typical thing. You know, Abraham also said that Sarah was his sister to the Pharaoh. Do you remember Potiphar's wife trying to seduce Joseph, and when he was not going to be seduced, she says to her husband, why did you bring this Hebrew slave to make sport of us, to mock us? The word is litzachek. Litzachek has a sexual connotation, sexual foreplay, sexual abuse. So Ishmael was behaving in a sexually abusive manner to his 3 or 4 year old brother who had just been weaned to show his dominance. This is a very Middle Eastern thing. To sexually abuse someone to show that you are dominant. It's a very Middle Eastern thing. That's why Sarah said, this child will not inherit Abraham. Out. That was the reason they were banished. The third time God says, take your one and only begotten son, Isaac, and sacrifice him on Mount Moriah. But the Muslims say it's not Isaac, it's Ishmael. And they have a holiday called Eid al-Adha. Eid al-Adha is the sacrifice of Ishmael. And by the way, does anyone know where Ishmael was supposed to be sacrificed? Was it Jerusalem? Was it Mount Moriah, like Abraham? No. Mecca, at the Black Stone, at the Kaaba. The holiest site of Islam, because Abraham, according to the Islamic tradition, built the Kaaba. So these people are living in another solar system. And I think it's interesting that Jerusalem is never mentioned in the Quran and Mecca is never mentioned in the Bible. This is not a question of sibling rivalries. You know, psychiatrists say this is sibling rivalries. What difference does it make? No, this is the spirit of good versus evil, of God versus Satan. Of those who are anointed versus those who are not anointed. And you know, in every family, you're going to have children, sons and daughters. Maybe one or two will be born again. The others, they're good kids, but they're not anointed. So in every family, you may have one, maybe, if you're lucky. If you're lucky, you'll have more that are there dedicated to serve God. And the others are dedicated to have a good time, make money, and you know, this kingdom. I know, it's in my family too. So Then you remember when, after the sacrifice, Sarah gets a heart attack and drops dead. You know, when she hears that her only son is going to be sacrificed on Mount Moriah, she dies from this. And so Abraham is 147. He takes Keturah as his wife. Abraham has a whole slew of children. He has concubines, no Viagra in those days. And God says, send all these kids away. Give them gifts. It is through Isaac your seed will be called. There was an anointing here. God is very clear. He says it's five times in Genesis. And it's repeated in the Gospel of Matthew. And yet there are Jews who prostrate themselves to the Muslims. They prostrate themselves to Arafat, to the Islamic agenda. And you've got Christians who prostrate themselves to Arafat and the agenda. You've got a pope. I don't want to attack the pope. He's done a lot for relations with the Jews and with Israel. But he goes to Damascus and kisses the Quran in the mosque in Damascus. Or you've got the World Council of Churches from the Protestants that embrace Islam. These people are legitimizing the religion that delegitimizes us. So any Jew, and especially any Christian who supports Islam, is a heretic and an infidel. This is heresy to support Islam in any way, because Islam is not legitimizing but delegitimizing the Jews and the Christians. Let's look at Allah. Allah is one of 360 pagan gods. Now, Allah generically means God. You know, in Hebrew you have Elohim, in Arabic you have Allah. But there's another Aleph Lamed Hey, A-L-H root. Elah means moon crescent. Al-Ilahi means moon crescent, God. It says in Deuteronomy, anyone who prays to the moon, the sun, and the stars should be taken to the gates of the city and stoned. This is in Deuteronomy 20. The three greatest gods of the 360 of ancient Mecca were the moon, the sun, and the stars. Muhammad heard voices. He had epilepsy, and as part of his condition, he heard voices. And so he comes to his wife, Khadija, and says, I'm hearing voices during my epileptic seizures. Am I a prophet, or am I crazy? He knew there was something wrong. He asked his wife. So what is his wife going to say? You're nuts? She says, oh, mon chéri, of course, you are the greatest and the latest of all the prophets. So he goes to the Jews, and he goes to the Christians. He says, I'm greater than Moses, and I'm greater than Jesus. So the Jews and the Christians say, you know, you're nuts. So now he's ticked off. So now he says, I'm going to create a religion greater than the religion of the Jews and the Christians. I'm going to create a God greater than their God. Have you ever heard the call to prayer of the Muslims? Where they say, Allahu Akbar. Forgive me for doing this in this house of God, but CNN translates that as God is great. Isn't it wonderful that God is great? Don't we know that God is great? But if CNN says it, better watch out. Because that's not what it means. Allahu Akbar means Allah is greater. Allah is greater? Allah is greater than the God of the Jews and the Christians who rejected Muhammad. Their God is the God of Ishmael, the forefather who was a war forefather. Allah is a war God, and Muhammad is a war prophet. Our God is a God of peace and a God of love. In other words, our God is a wimp. Their God is the God of the sword. That's a macho God. That's, of course, their God is greater than the God of the Jews and the Christians. That's what they believe. So, Allah is greater than God. Who said he was greater than God before his fall? Satan. Lucifer. Allah is Satan. Allah is Lucifer. I am like a lawyer in court trying to make my case. And I've just proven my case in theory. Now I'm going to prove it in practice. What have I learned in Christian churches, 400 of them? That the Jews are the apple of God's eye. It says so in the Bible. You know what I answer the Christians? You Christians are the apple of God's eye because you're grafted into us. I mean, if we're not the apple of God's eye, I don't think you want to be grafted into us. You want to be grafted into us, you better hope that we're the apple of God's eye. I mean, if you believe in Romans 9-11. And by the way, I believe in Romans 9-11. I get into a lot of trouble with the Jews when I say that. And I believe there's a reason. And the reason is the Jews sinned. The Jews did not share the gospel. They didn't teach God's word to the nations. Instead, we have these kosher laws. Kosher laws upon kosher laws upon kosher laws. And when Jesus says, a burden too grievous to be borne, he's right. But on the other hand, it doesn't mean you should throw the baby out with the bathwater. And you are under the law. But it's a different kind of law. You know, the Muslims, they're not under the law. You know why? Because none of those laws are in the Quran. Love the Lord thy God, love thy fellow as thyself, not in the Quran. Jesus teaches the Ten Commandments, not in the Quran, except for one, thou shalt not kill. But it's a little different. In the Quran it teaches, thou shalt not kill any man whom Allah has not deemed that you should kill, except for a just cause. You can kill for a just cause. You can lie for a just cause. You can steal, rape, destroy, burn, enslave for just cause. So Islam is not under any law, that's for sure. Chapter 5, verse 51 of the Quran. This I always start off with. Believers, Muslims, take neither the Jews nor the Christians for your friends. The Jews and the Christians are friends with one another. Whoever befriends them will become one of their number. Allah does not guide the wrongdoer. See, the Saudis quote me as saying that, but they changed the quote. But every Muslim, like if I say to you, Romans 8:28, everybody knows what that is. You know, that all things work for good for those who love the Lord. So all I have to say to you is, if you're a Muslim, Surah 5, verse 51, everybody knows what that is. Don't take the Jew or the Christian for your friend. But the Saudis, they try to obfuscate. Here it says in the Quran, do not take the Jew or the Christian for your friend. Allah does not guide the wrongdoer. It's a death sentence for anyone to take a Jew or a Christian for friend, sincerely. When the Muslim says to you that he's your friend or she's your friend, they're either lying to you or lying to Allah. It could be that they're lying to Allah. And if they really are, love them and pray for them. If they are lying to you, also love them and pray for them, but don't turn your back. Chapter 5, verse 60 of the Quran, and again, I want to quote this properly. Now, this is, you can't just read the Quran. You have to be trained how to read the Quran. Shall I tell you who will receive a worse reward from God, from Allah? Those whom Allah has cursed and with whom he has been angry, transforming them into apes and swine, and those who serve the devil. Worse is the plight of these, and they have strayed farther from the right path. Now, do you know who the children of the apes and the children of the swine are? The Jews and the Christians. And I have to tell you, my wife comes home crying from her work, and she hears Friday is the worst day, because that's what they preach on the mosque, on Temple Mount. And Sheikh Sabri says, kill the Jews, kill the Christians. Kill the Israelis, kill the Americans. Kill the children of the apes and kill the children of the swine. Every Palestinian Muslim schoolchild knows that the children of the apes are the Jews and the children of the swine are the Christians. Every true believing Muslim knows this verse. If you read the Quran and I didn't tell you that, you don't know. You think children of the apes, children of the swine must be some mythological thing. Generic. No, it's the Jews and the Christians. The Hadith, which is another form of teaching, not in the Quran, teaches that on the Day of Judgment there will be a final battle. And every Jew on the face of the earth will be destroyed. It'll be kind of like Adolf Hitler. And there will be some Jews who temporarily evade death. They will hide behind rocks and trees. And on that day, Allah will give mouths to the rocks and trees, and they will call out, O Muslim pursuers, there is a Jew hiding behind me. Come and kill him. So let me ask you a question. Does Allah love the Jews? He loves them dead. Is that the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? If we are the apple of God's eye, and if the world will be destroyed if there are no more Jews on the face of the earth, can that be God? That can only be Satan. So this is the third deception of Islam. By the way, another little story about my dear wife. I'm away from my wife 8 months of the year, unfortunately. Sometimes she travels with me, but she works in the Israeli radio. She's a civil servant. She has 1 month a year of vacation time. So most of the year she's there alone, and she goes and fills up the car in French Hill gas station. And it's in a Jewish neighborhood, but the gas station attendants are Muslims. They're Palestinian boys. My wife is a beautiful woman. Some of you have met her. And she used to be on TV. My wife was a TV announcer for 12 years in Arabic. And she's kind of a TV star in Israel among the Arabs. And they give her a red carpet treatment. And very sweet, these Palestinian boys. And just a few months ago, she went to fill up with gas. And they said to her, Rachel, you know, you were born in Egypt. Arabic's your mother tongue. You know us, we know you, you understand our culture, you're part of us. But we have a little problem with you. You're a Jew. And you know that on the Day of Judgment, we're going to have to kill all the Jews. And Allah will give mouths to the rocks and trees, and they will call out, O Muslim pursuers, there's a Jew hiding behind us, come and kill that Jew. And we don't want to kill you. Rachel, we love you. We don't want to kill you, but we will kill you if you don't become a Muslim. Because Allah has commanded us. So, you see, what I'm sharing with you is not academic. What I'm sharing with you is the marching orders of the Islamic peoples. Kill the Jew, kill the Christian. And one of the things my wife said to me when she was in Egypt was, the Jews are the Saturday people, the Christians are the Sunday people. We'll kill the Jews on Saturday, we'll kill the Christians on Sunday. There is no difference between what is happening now to the American troops in Iraq or the Western troops. Today they killed, unfortunately, almost 20 Italians. Christians. killed. They killed the Jew, they killed the Christian. We are the Ahl al-Kitab. This is the third deception of Islam. We have another 5 minutes and we'll finish this first hour, which is an hour and a half already. Fourth deception. This is very fast now. Jesus Christ of Islam is the same Jesus Christ of Christianity. And what do the Muslims say? Jesus will come back a second time as a Muslim. That's pretty funny. Because Islam was created about 7 centuries after the life and crucifixion of Jesus. But he comes back a Muslim. That's okay. He's reincarnated as a Muslim. And he comes down from the Golan Heights. He faces off against the Antichrist in battle and kills him with a spear. The Antichrist, of course, has to be a Jew, according to the Islamic tradition. And how do we know that the Antichrist cannot be a Jew, by the way? What is the sign of the Antichrist? 666. Well, we know Jews are 599. By the way, I heard that from a Christian, and when I heard that, I got so angry and so flustered. I said, that's the most anti-Semitic thing I ever heard in my life. And then I just started laughing so hard. I said, I'm going to use that joke every time. So Jesus kills the Antichrist, goes up to the Temple Mount, prays with 400,000 Muslims the morning Islamic service. Then Jesus, the Muslim, comes down, breaks all the crosses with his 400,000 Muslims. It's basically a pogrom. It's a riot, basically. They destroy all the churches of the Christians. They destroy all the synagogues of the Jews. And on that day of judgment, all the Jews and the Christians, who are considered one people, the Jews and the Christians are the Ahl al-Kitab, one people, the people of the book. All the Jews and the Christians who have not embraced Allah as the greatest of all the gods, remember, 360 gods, and Muhammad, the greatest and latest of all the prophets, all these Jews and Christians will have their throats slit by Jesus Christ, the Muslim. Is that the same Jesus? If you don't understand what I just said, I have a $3 Clinton bill in my wallet. I'll be glad to show it to you afterwards. The fifth deception of Islam is that the Quran is the divine infallible word of Allah to Muhammad, and that the Quran replaces the Bible of the Jews and the Christians. And I need an hour to do this, but I'm not going to do it. I'm just going to give you a few sentences. And if you're interested, get my first book, which is Fanatic Islam, a Global Threat. Because in addition to predicting 9/11, already in 1997, the book talks about kamikaze pilots and destruction of America. But it also teaches in chapter 19 about the numerology, the numerological code of 19 in the Quran. Which is a very Jewish number, by the way, because the Quran was written by a rabbi. And there are 117 chapters in the Quran, but 22 of them begin, 22 letters in the Hebrew alphabet. 22 chapters of the Quran start with the letters ALM. Nobody knows what this means in the Islamic world, but the rabbi who taught me this said that ALM means Ani lo ma'amin, I don't believe any of this, or Elelelo mashma, these verses mean nothing. The Quran could not have been written by a Muslim because the Muslims were illiterate nomads. What they did was they hijacked a Jewish rabbi and an Armenian Orthodox or Syrian Orthodox priest, put them in a pit, made them write the Quran, and then killed them, even though they promised them their freedom. So these are the five deceptions of Islam, and I could go indeed into depth as to how the Quran is a plagiarism, a fabrication, or fraud. But what I want to basically conclude with, before we take our little break, then we continue, is that Islam is a system which has a plagiarism as a book, has a Satan as a god, has an epileptic prophet who heard voices when he fell to the ground with his epileptic seizures. It is a religion of war, and it is a religion of hatred. And God have mercy on all of us from this Islam, and God have mercy on the Muslims themselves. And before we take our break, I just want to say again and again, pray for the Muslims, love the Muslims, be a witness to them, and don't turn your backs. Thank you very much.
For a complete listing of materials to further enhance your personal Bible study, or to receive a free 1-year subscription to Chuck Missler's monthly Christian Intelligence News Journal personal update, contact Koinonia House at 1-800-KHOUSE1. That's 1-800-KHOUSE1. Or you can write to Koinonia House at P.O. Box D, Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, 83816-0347. To fax your correspondence, dial 208-773-6312.